Hello. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. We're located in Lowell, Massachusetts, and we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. I am Jean Creedberg, and Ken and I will be reading to you this morning from the Lowell Sun of Sunday, December 7, 2025. And I'd just like to remind you that LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. And Ken is going to start the reading for us this morning. Ken?
From the local news section of the Sunday Sun, I'm going to be reading the column. New Rourke Bridge set to rise. Residents will have a front-row seat and a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to witness a major bridge construction project in Lowell. Readers, behold the new Rourke Bridge. Drivers traveling along Pawtucket Boulevard and Old Ferry Road in Pawtucketville have probably noticed an increase in orange construction barrels and flags marking spots on the Merrimack River side of the road. Site work for the new Rourke Bridge project is underway, with extensive shoreline work taking place to prepare for the phased platform build-out starting this winter. This past Monday, this intrepid reporter trudged through mud to get an up-close look at work being done at the abandoned lift station tucked in between the river and the boulevard, slightly west of the existing Rourke Bridge. Even in early winter, the area had thick vegetation with numerous trees and shrubs running down to the shore for at least 50 feet. But survey crews have been busy, and the area was a riot of red, blue, and orange flag stakes that Gogan said delineate wetlands limits, clearing limits, erosion controls, and to show the temp trestle layout. In fact, one bright orange stake was labeled temp trestle in black marker. A trestle is a framework or support column for a bridge. Temporary trestle construction is the staging ground for building out the cofferdams on which the six bridge piles will be constructed. Cofferdam work is expected to start this winter season, said John Gogan with Massachusetts Department of Transportation Communications by email Friday. A backhoe and dump truck were also on site, removing existing material at the abandoned lift station and doing site cleanup preparation for the laid-down yard, which is where supplies and materials will be staged. The new bridge's construction will start at this location and work its way south past the eastern corner of the Collegiate Charter School of Lowell School's athletic field, closest to the Wood Street entrance of the Kermit Bridge off Middlesex Street in the Highlands neighborhood. The alignment of the new bridge is at an angle west of the existing bridge. The new Rourke Bridge span will arc over the Merrimack River on its six concrete piers. The project consists of a six-span, seven-girder steel bridge with bicycle and pedestrian access. The new bridge, which has 75-year service life, will be three times as wide as the existing two-lane bridge and have four lanes with shoulders, two going in either direction. And all of that work will be visible to people traveling through the area. Unlike the metal cage-like design of the old Rourke Bridge, the new bridge is open-style design with sight lines of the Merrimack River. Pedestrians along the Vandenberg Esplanade on the north side of the river will have an excellent view of the construction. So get your walking shoes and field glasses ready because the show is about to begin. And this part of the column was written by Melanie Gilbert. Real transparency is not that difficult. It feels pretty much impossible now to go to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Facility in Burlington on a weekday and not find some sort of demonstration on the adjacent lawn against the human rights abuses taking place inside. Such was the scene that greeted U.S. Representative Seth Moulton Monday morning when he arrived at the facility for his second inspection of the inside this year. His message upon exiting the facility was that things inside had improved in the sense that there were fewer detainees being crammed into a small space, but that the underlying problems remain in the sense that those detainees are still not given adequate accommodations. That detainees aren't being packed together like sardines looks like a small amount of progress in the fight to push back on rampant authoritarianism. But, as Moulton pointed out, it isn't necessarily a positive sign. People getting arbitrarily detained by ICE across Massachusetts are being brought to the Burlington facility. ICE is not the most forthcoming agency when it comes to detainees, data, evidence, and really most things. But it is at least believable that the Burlington office is not being used as much as long-term detention facility as it was this year. The problem with that, though, is that detainees are instead being whisked away to facilities in other states, away from their families or any legal representation they may have. The reported conditions in these places across the country can vary. But the crux of the issue is that detainees are being moved to different facilities across the country as a way to undermine the justice system and due process as it applies to them. Such was the case of Ishula Garay, who spent just an hour in Burlington before spending a month in an ICE facility in Rhode Island, before he was brought to Georgia for reasons that are still unclear. One of Moulton's suggestions was that Massachusetts should have a purpose-built immigration detention center instead of having to rely on what is supposed to be just an office building. This drew some negative reactions from some protesters in the crowd who want ICE to simply be gone. But there is at least some logic to his idea in a vacuum. With an actual detention center in the state, ICE would lack an excuse to send detainees to states they have never been to, and it would theoretically keep them close to their attorneys and support networks. That is all well and good if you believe ICE to be in any way acting in good faith, which I find to be hard sell. To this point, ICE has gone out of its way to not provide evidence that any given immigrant they detain is here illegally, even when said immigrant has documentation that entirely contradicts the ICE narrative. With the insanely bloated budget given to ICE through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, one would think they could start the process of using a little pocket change to start building such a facility here. But that isn't happening. The agency has clearly shown no issues with ignoring judges' orders, the Constitution, and basic questions of accountability from reporters. So while it is good that Moulton has been able to get inside and report back on the actual problems he was able to observe, the nature of his visit inherently means one cannot trust that he was allowed to see the reality of the inside of that office building every day. Lawmakers across the country have essentially taken the only two paths available to them when it comes to gaining access to ICE facilities. The first and most attention-grabbing method has been for senators and representatives to simply show up at the facilities without informing ICE beforehand and demanding to be allowed inside. For the most part, this has been ineffective in stated goals of accessing these facilities. The second method is what Moulton did, to arrange the visit well in advance. This is effective in that lawmakers do it in a way are gaining access, but rather ineffective in that you cannot guarantee that ICE did not prepare the facility ahead of the visit so that the lawmaker can't see the true scope of what happens there. This will never happen because Congress, on the whole, lacks a spine and has capitulated entirely to the whims of the executive branch. But legislation needs to be passed barring ICE from turning away lawmakers who show up unannounced. It would absolutely create opportunities for a lot of performative nonsense, perhaps from both sides of the aisle. But ICE has long since lost the benefit of the doubt. Real transparency would mean being able to demonstrate that everything is being done above board without getting the heads up first. And this part of the column was written by Peter Currier. Remembering election nights of long ago. The passing of a man like George O'Hare brings out the urge to memorialize him. O'Hare died on November 26th at age 87 after a long illness. He retired 3 years ago from the school committee of the Greater Lowell Technical High School. Before his retirement, his friend and fellow board member, Curtis LeMay, contacted the Sun to ask that we write an appreciation of his life before he retired. That appreciation was published on August 20th, 2022. That story did not include the following recollection, which was published in the column the following Sunday. Times changed radically over the years O'Hare was in public life. And one of those changes was in election night traditions. When he was not serving the youth of Lowell and the surrounding area, O'Hare worked for Verizon. But he began work as a telephone lineman for New England Telephone, the phone company, as it was simply known, up to 1984, after serving in the Marine Corps. He retired from Verizon in 2002 as a manager. O'Hare grew up on Moore Street and still lives there, besides his daughter, Dara O'Hare. Next door is a Pentecostal church, but once it was an old fellows hall. During campaign season, it became George O'Hare's campaign headquarters. He made sure it was outfitted with the best in telephone equipment. His daughter remembers telephone lines everywhere. Back in the day before the internet and cell phones, Dara O'Hare recalls election nights with phones constantly ringing in results from wards, precincts, and city hall. Election nights often didn't end until early mornings back then. Now results are known fairly quickly, and winners are apparent by 9 p.m. A lot has changed in communications since George O'Hare first shimmied up the telephone pole. That is, unless a recount is needed in a race where two candidates are separated by 10 votes, as happened in this year's city council race. From hand-counted paper ballots that took hours to tally to ballots that computers can read in minutes, O'Hare's life spanned enormous changes in technology generally and elections in particular. And this part of the column was written by Prudence Brighton. And Jeannie, that's the column for this week.
Okay, thank you, Ken. And returning to, I've finally up and running here. So we'll return to the front page of the Lowell Sun of Sunday, December 7th, 2025, and the lead article, Public Health, Proposed Ordinance Restricts Needle Exchange Program. Board of Health fears rise of diseases like HIV, Hep C, dirty needles, no vote schedule. There is a picture here of the Massachusetts Department of Public Health Sharps container disposal site in the fourth floor hallway of Lowell's Health and Human Services on Merrimack Street. Melanie Gilbert, Lowell Sun. In response to several city councilor motions, City Councilor Corey Williams presented an ordinance to the body at its November 25 meeting that bans needle exchange programs, including Sharps, containers, and kiosks in areas around Lowell, public, private, and charter schools. In a letter to the council, City Manager Tom Golden said that, quote, under the proposed ordinance, needle exchange distribution or collection shall be prohibited within 1,000 feet of any school. A map generated by Management Information Systems showed the scale of that proposal, the result of a September 9 meeting in which the council passed motions to regulate the city's needle exchange program without input from the city's Health and Human Services Department or the Board of Health. The proposed ordinance effectively closes off vast swaths of the downtown area where both the majority of the targeted population is present, as well as where a variety of harm reduction services are delivered, including the Lowell Community Health Center, the Lowell Transitional Living Center, and even the city's health department on Merrimack Street. At its December 3 meeting, Board of Health Chair Joanne Keegan said the ordinance would, quote, basically eliminate the needle exchange program, unquote. The proposed buffers zone do not extend to large sections of the Highlands, both sides of Princeton Boulevard from the Merrimack River to past Pine Street, the northeast corner of Belvedere, essentially both sides of Andover Street, with pockets around Douglas Road and Rogers Street, the southeast corner of South Lowell around Interstate 495 north and south, and the streets south of the Shaughnessy and Butler Schools, and pockets in both Centerville and Pawtucketville. In the acre, the Weston Avenue studios fall outside the buffer zone, as do numerous streets flanking Middlesex Street. But Keegan said relocating services to many of those areas was impractical due to accessibility issues and the at-risk population. Although the ordinance only specifically refers to a 1,000-foot buffer zone around schools, MIS also compiled a map to show the impact if the ordinance was amended to include parks, which the council also proposed. In that scenario, only Belvedere, the Highlands, and Pawtucketville will be potential areas open to harm reduction services like needle exchange programs. The city of Lowell is a syringe service provider community. In 2016, under the Governor Charlie Baker administration, cities and towns in the Commonwealth were approved to establish syringe services programs or needle exchange programs. More than 86 of the 351 communities in Massachusetts, including Lowell, set up an SSP. Through these programs, you can get sterile needles and syringes free of cost, disposed of used needles and syringes, and get connected to other services such as testing for hepatitis C, HIV, and other sexually transmitted infections, overdose education, and Narcan, naloxone, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health website said. But Lowell's SSP program was born from a health crisis and not from a preventative care model. In June of 2018, former Health and Human Services Director Karen Vigroux, V-I-G-R-O-U-X, approached the Board of Health regarding a letter of support for an SSP, which included a comprehensive needle exchange program to be run by a local organization. The program was developed to address an outbreak of human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, which can lead to AIDS, a potentially fatal disease. SSPs also mitigated the spread of hepatitis C and other blood-borne illness that were on the rise throughout the city. Clients can exchange dirty or used needles for clean needles to reduce the spread of disease. The ordinance also bans sharp containers within 1,000 feet of a school, which concerned healthcare and social service providers. Locations such as the Lowell Senior Center and Elliott Church use the kiosks to safely collect used needles from a variety of uses, such as needles used for insulin, immunosuppression, and weight loss medications. Although the city of Lowell is a SSP community, Elliott Church is not a participating partner, but it does collect needles in the community. Elliott Church's Day Center Executive Director Joyce Hughes said the ordinance would require the church to remove its sharps container. People use it, she said, by text Friday. Staff uses it when we clean up outside. Health and Human Services Director Lisa Gordon said if the ordinance passes, it would take away the department's standalone kiosks and its hallway offices on Merrimack Street. That would be a problem, she said during the Board of Health meeting on December 3. Diabetics drop off their syringes, for instance. Throwing syringes in a trash or recycling bin or disposing of them anywhere that is not safe needle disposal container is against the law and poses a health and safety risk to the public and sanitation workers. The ordinance does not address alternative disposal sites for non-needle exchange users. In a letter to the city manager November 25, Lisa Golden said banning the needle exchange program could set back efforts to contain communicable diseases. The Board of Health would advise against an ordinance of prohibiting SSP 1,000 feet from schools and parks as it would restrict critical services for clients who need them, she said. Although the ordinance largely neuters the availability and accessibility of the syringe service program, it still required that the demographic profiles of the participants served should be collected. From working at DPH, I know that they would not be looking for that information, nor would they feel it appropriate to collect that kind of information, Keegan said. It wouldn't be relevant. The council voted to refer the ordinance to the City Council Public Safety Subcommittee. That body is chaired by Councillor Vesna Nguyen, an at-large representative with Councillors Sikori Chow of the Lowell Highland, of the Lower Highlands, and Paul Ratha Yem for the Acre. The council meets Tuesday, at which time it will vote on its remaining schedule for the month. No subcommittee meetings are on the agenda. In January, a new council will be seated with new committee assignments. The ordinance needs some work, Keegan said. Hopefully, we can have some input. Ken, might you have something else for us?
Yes, I do, Jeannie. Now I have one of the lead stories from the local news of the Sunday Sun. And this column is entitled 40B Housing. Draken ZBA OKs Downsized Murphy's Farm Permit. And this was written by Prudence Brighton. Draken. As expected, the Zoning Board of Appeals signed off on a contentious Murphy Farm Chapter 40B housing project in East Draken at its December 4th meeting. However, the 4-0 vote to grant a comprehensive permit does not mark the end of the process. This is not the last step, but it is an important milestone, Selectman Don Plummer told The Sun after the meeting. The Murphy's Farm proposal, a mix of affordable and market-rate housing, has been under review by the ZBA after Mass Housing approved site plans for the project in February 2023. Mass Housing is a quasi-state agency that approves 40B site plans and provides funding for them. The proposal has been substantially revised since it was first presented. In 2023, developer Kevin O'Brien proposed a 300-unit complex of entirely four-bedroom apartments in 47 buildings on 50 acres. In August 2023, the ZBA opened a public hearing on whether to give O'Brien a comprehensive permit for the project. Over the intervening months, the developer has provided site plans, consulting reports, peer reviews, traffic engineering reports, and other engineering documents to support the case for a comprehensive permit. The size of the project drew vehement opposition led by a group called Citizens Against Reckless Development in Dracut, which has a Facebook following of nearly 1,000 members. The plans would downsize from 300 to 268 units on 33 acres. But the downsizing was not over. The comprehensive permit the ZBA approved on December 4th has been downsized again to 200 units of garden-style apartments on 30 acres. The reduction in size caused the only surprise at the meeting. ZBA member Scott Mallory said, "I'm having second thoughts about the 200 units. That number was only discussed at a meeting in October." Mallory was not sure they'd justified the reduction and was afraid of O'Brien would sue. ZBA Chair Brian Lucier reminded Mallory and the board that the course open to O'Brien is to appeal the decision to the Housing Appeals Committee. O'Brien declined to comment on the ZBA vote. After the vote, Lucier read a statement saying, "Getting to this point has taken significant effort on the part of volunteer board members, committed citizens, staff, and the applicant's team. The project was initially proposed as 300 four-bedroom units on approximately 50 acres. He continued, "In part, responding to feedback, the final project proposal was for 268 units, mix of 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms on approximately 33 acres. The decision, as approved by the ZBA, allows for construction of up to 200 units with a similar mix of bedroom counts." ZBA members over the next few days will go to Town Hall to sign the document, which will then go to the Town Clerk's office. When their signatures have been affixed to the comprehensive permit, O'Brien has 20 days to file any appeal if he chooses to make one. Any other aggrieved party can appeal the decision to the Land Court or Superior Court. The Town's Conservation Commission also has a part to play, reviewing plans for compliance with local conservation laws. Jeannie?
Okay, thanks, Ken. Returning to the front page of the Lowell Sun of Sunday, December 7, another lead story, Sun Santa Fund. The Christmas spirit is very alive and well. Panagiotakis Benefit Party once again breaks its fundraising record as event is held in memory of his late mother. And there is a large color picture showing Gianna Panagiotakis addressing a crowded blue shamrock on December 5, 2025, during the 29th annual benefit party for the Sun Santa Fund, and it's all about the Kids Foundation, organized by her father, former state senator Stephen Panagiotakis. Her father was not present at the organized by her father. He was the former state. He was not present at the event this year due to the death of his mother, Edna Panagiotakis 2 days before. Peter Currier, Lowell's son. The main schedule of this year's Sun Santa season is officially underway after a packed, crowded, gathered at the Blue Shamrock Friday night for Steve Panagiotakis' 29th annual benefit party for the Sun Santa Fund, and it's all about the Kids Foundation. The annual benefit party has become among the biggest fundraisers of the year for the Sun Santa Fund, with this year's event raising an estimated $45,000, a record for the Panagiotakis family. This breaks the event's record set just last year when $40,000 was raised for Sun Santa. The former state senator's party came with a somber note this year after Edna Panagiotakis, Steve's mother, died Wednesday evening at the age of 88. Steve was not present at this year's party, but his daughters, Gianna and Alexandria, were both there on his behalf, while the event was dedicated to their late grandmother. We are just so very thankful to have everyone here this evening. Unfortunately, my dad's mother, Edna Barrett Panagiotakis, passed away on Wednesday, so the rest of the family could not be here. Gianna said Friday night, but it is so touching to see everyone here tonight. She loved this event, and the Christmas spirit is very alive and well with everybody around. We are just so thankful for the community and everybody being here. The money raised from the Panagiotakis benefit party goes toward the Sun Santa Fund's mission, which since 1988 has been to help financially struggling families in Greater Lowell to put a proper holiday meal on their table and have Christmas gifts to give to their children. Hundreds of families are supported by the Sun Santa Fund every year, thanks to events like the one held by the Panagiotakis family. The party originated in 1996 after Steve's first successful campaign for the state Senate, and at first consisted mainly of his campaign staff at the time, but it has grown significantly in the nearly three decades since then. Similarly to Sun Santa, It's All About the Kids supports local families by collecting donated toys to distribute so parents can have a Christmas gift to give to their children if they otherwise cannot afford one. The group works with Lowell Public Schools, local social workers, and organizations like the Lowell Community Health Center and Merrimack Valley Food Bank to identify families in need of this support. Lowell Sun Charities President Kevin Coughlin said the event Friday was, quote, a night of happiness and a night of sadness after the loss of Edna. But thanks to the generosity and compassion of the family, they were really wanting this to be a success tonight because so many needy individuals in this community depend on this evening, said Coughlin. I'm really thrilled tonight. Lowell every year surprises me because not only are people so generous with a lot of events, tonight there is an event at UMass Lowell with their hockey game, events at the city and private fundraisers for their organizations, and yet this place is packed with people who linger and share their joy. Sun Santa Coordinator Suzanne Reese recognized the loss of Panagiotakis' family experienced and thanked Steve and his family for their support. Tonight, we're thinking of Steve at this difficult time and the loss of his mother. His daughters, Gianna and Alexandria, stepped in and were wonderful hosts of the event. We are so incredibly grateful to Steve for everything he does for the Sun Santa Fund, said Reese. The generosity of all who attended will help so many in need in our community during the holiday season. Sun Santa provides assistance to local families in the 23 communities served by the Sun. Applications for assistance are processed by our agency partners. the Salvation Army, and community teamwork. Families receive toy and food vouchers based on their financial need and family size. Toy vouchers are redeemable at Walmart and Tewksbury. Food vouchers are accepted at all Market Basket stores, though through the generosity of the local community, Sun Santa raises the funds to directly support this voucher system. Sun Santa's donors come from many walks of life, from public officials to local banks and businesses to children who are learning about kindness and generosity through fundraising drives at their school. Thanks to this hard work and donor support, we have always met our goal. Every dollar matters and no gift is too small. Secure online donations can be made at lowellsun.com/sunsanta. lowellsun.com/sunsanta, or by mail to the Sun Santa Fund, Post Office Box 2439, Lowell, Mass. 01851. Again, that's Sun Santa Fund, Post Office Box 2439, Lowell, Mass. 01851. All donations are listed in the Sun's print and online publications. Groups donating $500 or more are welcome to submit a digital photo that will be printed in the Sun on a space available basis. Donation photos from area schools for a contribution of any amount will be printed in the newspaper as space is available. The Sun Santa season continues with more opportunities for giving on Sunday and again this coming weekend. Yesterday, December 7th, the Polish-American Veterans of Lowell presented their 17th annual Sun Santa Family Christmas Party from 1 to 5 at the Dom Polski Club on Coburn Street. The event will be held in memory of Edward P. Kuczek, K-U-C-Z-E-K, a lifelong supporter of the Lowell Sun Fund. There is a $5 requested donation. Food, music, raffles, children's activities, and a special appearance from Santa. The public was invited and welcomed to attend. All proceeds went to the Sun Santa Fund. December 13th, State Rep. Jim Arciero will host his annual drive-in and drop-off event to benefit the Sun Santa Fund and local families from 10 a.m. to noon at the Littleton Police Department at 500 Great Road. Please bring a new unwrapped toy and or check made out to Sun Santa Fund. On December 13 also, Lowell Mayor Dan Rourke will host a Sun Santa Drive, Pints for a Purpose, to benefit the Sun Santa Fund and local families from noon to 4 p.m. at the Old Court at 2931 Central Street, Lowell. Rourke's event is new this year, and he told the Sun November 21 his goal brought the event... Wait a minute. Rourke's event is new this year, and he told the Sun November 21 this goal through the event is to raise $10,000 to help 100 families in Greater Lowell. Rourke said City Manager Tom Golden will conduct a live auction during the event at 2:30 p.m. Donations to Sun Santa will be accepted during the event in the form of a check or cash. School committee member-elect Danielle McFadden and Pride Star Trinity EMS Senior Vice President of Marketing and Public Relations Chris Dick will co-host that night alongside Rourke. And there are quite a few pictures that are also associated with this article. One shows the former state representative Steve Panagiotakis at the 29th annual benefit party for the Sun Santa Fund, and it's all about the Kids Foundation. That was on December 5 in honor of his mother, Edna, who died. Another picture shows guests arriving at the Blue Shamrock on December 5 with donations to the Sun Santa Fund, and it's all about the Kids Foundation. And another shows Lowell City Manager Tom Golden announcing the numbers for various raffle prizes during former State Senator Steve Panagiotakis's 29th annual benefit party at Sun Santa Fund. And the Blue Shamrock was packed. It shows the people gathered around a pool table. It was packed on December 5 during the 29th benefit party for the Sun Santa Fund, and it's all about the kids. Another picture shows a pile of donated toys stacked against the Blue Shamrock. I'm sorry, hold on. I lost that. Let me see if I can get it back. Here it is. A pile of donated toys stacked against the Blue Shamrock window slowly grew throughout the night as attendees filed into the bar on December 5. Okay, Ken, do you have something for us?
Yes, I do, Jeannie, and I'm going to be reading another article from the local news section of the Sunday Sun. And this column is entitled, Drake It, School Administration Reorganization Underway. Cost of Changes Unclear. And this column was written by Prudence Brighton. Drake It. Organizational changes are underway in the school department's central administration and are expected to be fully implemented by July 1st when fiscal 2027 begins. The school committee unanimously supported the reorganization of the business office, a change which will divide the school business manager's functions between a finance director and an operations director. Superintendent of Schools Stephen Stone told the committee at its November 24th meeting that some work is already underway to align staff with changes to their responsibilities. Stone said that the district, given financial constraints, has been forced to operate its business and operational functions within a suboptimal structure for a school district the size of ours. He added, the current construct is not sustainable. To school committee questions about the cost, Stone said it was too soon to know. Decisions about personnel, including hiring new employees, will affect the cost. He expects it will cost more than the current structure. The new director of finance will focus entirely on business operations, budgeting, and overall finance. The finance director will fill the statutory role of school business administrator on the new organizational chart. The new director of operations will manage the food service, transportation, information technology, and facilities groups. Among the open questions concerning the new structure involves the job of supervisor of buildings and grounds. That position was held until August by Andrew Graham, a longtime employee of the school district who continued to work in that position after he retired. Graham's post-retirement wages caused the Middlesex County Retirement Board to tell him he couldn't work any more hours in 2025. He could return in January, but his intention is not known, according to Stone. Graham is appealing the retirement board's decision that he must repay $91,000 in excess pension payments. Also reporting to the director of operations will be a director of technology. The ever-increasing changes in technology, both on the business side and the academic side, require a new position with supervisory responsibilities for the district's IT technicians. The new director of technology means elevating the role of network manager. Currently, a network manager maintains the school's network. Other school districts already have a similar structure, Stone said. The process of filling the new positions will take time, Stone said, as will changing roles and responsibilities of current employees. Jeannie?
Okay, thanks, Ken. Here's a couple of just interesting little tidbits here. A heartbreaking title loss for Tewksbury. Tewksbury quarterback Will Harrison huddles over Scituate's Cameron Cerusi to reach the end zone during Saturday's Division IV state championship game at Gillette Stadium. Tewksbury fell 42-41 in a thriller. That's from James Thomas of the Lowell Sun. Must have been quite a game. Another little tidbit about football here. High school football back-to-back champs by Barry Scanlon. The Shawshene Tech football team won its second consecutive Division V state championship Friday night with a 14-7 win over a tough Foxborough team in Gillette Stadium in Foxborough. The Billerica School has now won 27 straight games. And there's a lot of pictures with this one. Shawshene Tech head coach Al Constable celebrates after guiding the Rams to a 14-7 win over Foxborough for back-to-back state titles, capping a perfect season. Another shows Shawshene Tech players hoisting the Aganis Division V state trophy after defeating Foxborough in the championship game for the second straight season. Another shows shows Shawshene Tech's Landon Benoit charging toward Foxborough quarterback Cam Dulesky during Friday's Division V Super Bowl. And the last picture shows Shawshene Tech's Jake Banda finding daylight for a first down during Friday's division game. So we had some wins and some losses in the local area. Ken, anything of interest?
Not really, Jeannie.
Okay, I can get us to the education page here. I'm not very adept with this, but I'm getting better, this computer business here. But hold on, education, here it is. Another interesting article here. Leaders roll out new wage transparency tools. I wanted to read this. Voke Tech Schools, Neshoba Tech holds annual open house. And it's just three pictures, but the first one shows chef instructor Carly Capraro, C-A-P-R-A-R-O, talking about the culinary arts program with the Lavery family of Townsend, Mallory, and Stephen, and daughters Daphne, a seventh grader, and Gwen, a fifth grader, during the annual open house at Neshoba Valley Technical High School on November 2. Another picture shows Dennis and Heather Dietrich of Shirley, both graduates of Neshoba Valley Technical High School, listening to chef instructor Paul Wilson talk about the culinary arts program with his daughters during eighth grader Annabelle and 7-year-old Jojo during the Westford School's annual open house on November 2. And the last picture shows Mariana Lourdes of Westford and Reminis Carrillo of Chelmsford representing the Skills USA Club during the annual open house of Neshoba Valley Technical High School on November 2. Mariana is the state historian of the Massachusetts chapter of Skills USA. I don't know if I'll be able to get this whole article in, but leaders roll out new wage transparency tools. Boston's Women Workforce Council form units, employers, policy officials. Lowell. Employers looking to learn how the state's new wage transparency law can help them strengthen their workforce gathered at UMass Lowell on October 29 for a forum presented by the Boston Women's Workforce Council and attended by State Secretary of Labor and Workforce Development, Lauren Jones. Signed into law last year by Governor Maura Healey, the 24 Francis Perkins Workplace Equity Act acts to promote wage parity and transparency by establishing new requirements for reporting for Massachusetts employers. The law's namesake was a former U.S. Labor Secretary who was the first woman to serve in the presidential cabinet. The law is the first in the nation that seeks out information from employers to proactively build a more diverse and robust workforce, according to former Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Murphy, co-chair of the BWWC and a longtime pay equity advocate. This is the data and the database we need to build good public policy, she said. The session drew lawmakers and nearly 40 businesses, nonprofits, education, and municipal leaders from throughout the Bay State. In addition to Jones, the panel included UMass Lowell Chancellor Julie Chen and BWWC member Lisa Brothers, principal and chair of NICHT Engineering Boston and UMass Lowell graduate. Under the Act, employers with 100 or more employees must submit federally required equal employment opportunity wage data to the state, a second facet of the law which came into effect on October 29th, requires employees with 25 or more employers with 25 or more employees to disclose the pay range for all job positions. Under the new law, the state aggregates this information as a tool for employers to use as they recruit employees and determine wages, benefits, and career paths. To learn more about the BWWC's work, you can visit bwwc.org. And we're going to bid you farewell for today. Please stay tuned for more coming your way. If you do go out, bundle up. It's awfully chilly out there, but it's a beautiful, sunny, wintry day.
Have a great week.
Stay tuned for more coming your way.